Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Callum Borchers. P. Carl says he's lived a double life, the first as a woman for 50 years, now as a man. In his new memoir, he tries to untangle both of those lives. The book is called Becoming a Man, The Story of a Transition. Carl is a distinguished artist in residence at Emerson College in Boston and the Anschutz Fellow at Princeton University for spring 2020. And he's in the process of developing his memoir into a play with the American Repertory Theater, or the ART, in Cambridge. P. Carl joined us in Studio 3 to tell us why he wanted to share his story.
I wanted to write it for a couple of reasons. The first being there is so little out there about trans experience. So I think any time you're adding to the stories that are missing in our culture, that might be helpful somewhere down the line. And I say in the book, I hope that it's helpful. And the other, I think, was to really chronicle in some ways this experience of living as a woman for so long because I transitioned so late and then seeing sort of the world from the other side. So this idea of double consciousness, of sort of living parallel lives, and that was of real interest to me in terms of both thinking and experience.
And you begin by writing about the day that you realized that you were now fully recognized by society as a man. I wouldn't ordinarily comment on the physical appearance of our guests, but it's relevant here. If you walked by me on the street, I would just say, there goes another man. I wouldn't think anything of it. So you were passing, right, is sort of the parlance. What was that day like? This was a significant moment in your life.
I mean, for me, it was euphoric. It's waiting half a century to really feel like others see you as you've always seen yourself. It was just the day that, going forward, I was never misgendered again, and a day that I will probably never forget. And it was also complicated, as I write in the book. People started calling me boss, for example, it's like I had stepped into a world of experience and privilege that I had not known before. So it was mixed in that way, but mostly euphoric.
And you write about recognizing that you really like being identified as a man, and leaning into what can sometimes veer into what you describe as toxic masculinity. So how do you sort of try to walk that line? I mean, what goes through your heads in those moments when you think about now as a man, how you treat women?
Yeah. I mean, I think one of the things about the book, I very intentionally wrote it in present tense, and I call it becoming because it is a process of becoming. And I really like masculinity. I like being a guy. I like places where guys hang out. I like locker rooms and bars and that kind of thing. And those are interesting places. They're complex, as are most spaces where men are talking among men. And so I, in some ways, I'm somebody who's just watching and learning and wanting to figure out where my voice and place is in that. You read in the book, I'm very honest. Sometimes I make mistakes. Sometimes I join in as I was trying to figure out what it meant to fit in. And I tried to make the experience of becoming as messy as it was.
How does that alter maybe the way that you see other men? Because what I'm hearing there is you feel maybe a certain amount of peer pressure in certain social situations. And I wonder if that makes you more critical of your fellow men or more sympathetic in a way where you see behaviors you don't like, but now you can relate to the pressures that they feel to fit in, as you said.
Yeah. I mean, when you sit in those spaces, you have to decide how many times you're going to break in per conversation. And you have to really think about what's my role here as a good man. And I was both stunned by how not far we've come in some of our conversations about women in those spaces. And I was also in some way sympathetic. It's a very strong draw to just kind of nod your head even if you don't agree.
I'd love it if you read it a little bit for us.
Yeah,
could you
sure.
pick up? This is on page 17, early in your book, your first chapter, and you're reckoning with this contradiction that you feel in your own head and with men more broadly. Would you read for us?
Sure. I see all the flaws of men, all the ways their fragility makes them dangerous and powerful and dismissive and sure that they know it all. And I love being a man. I love masculinity, and I love hanging out with men. My body is a contradiction. I feel a fiery rage toward men for treating me like a woman, for making women seem crazy and emotional and inferior, for what men did to me. I feel so much joy living in a man's body, my natural physicality, and I'm trying to find a path toward becoming a good man.
So there's that phrase again, good man. You mentioned it a moment ago, and there it is in that passage. What does it mean to be a good man in 2020, do you think?
Well, I think that's really a great question. I don't think I have an answer to it. I think it's a conversation that we as a country need to be having, what white masculinity looks like in its best form. I think we've are experiencing it very much in its worst form, so we have a pretty good handle on that. And I think it's a conversation that is very hard to raise, creates a lot of defensiveness. What I've found as people have been reading the book, I've heard from a lot of men of, you know, 40s, 50s saying this is an interesting and helpful path into what are very difficult discussions.
We're talking with P. Carl about his transition and his book called Becoming a Man. And this book, Carl, it's packed with really compelling anecdotes. One that stands out to me is this interaction that you have with your swimming coach, your trainer, who is out to you as a gay man, but you're not out to him as a trans man. And you wrestle with this. Some of your friends seem to think perhaps you owe it to him to be out. And then you question, well, is that really apples to apples, or are those different things? How do you think about that now as you look back?
Well, it is actually quite complicated. I don't know what the reaction is to a trans man in any given locker room or any given bar, or there's a level of danger for me to be out in that way. And the conversation that my friend who was shocked I wasn't out, I said, I really, really wrestled in the book with whether those two things were the same. And I don't really have an answer to that. I know as somebody who feels very comfortable in my masculinity and wants to just have spaces where I'm not representing some, you know, I represent trans or I represent queer, it felt important for me to have some spaces where I wasn't necessarily representing anything. In the end, of course, Alex and I are good friends, and, you know, he figured out I was trans, and we've had a really great relationship. And he really gave me a lot of support in coming to be inhabited in my own body.
I like the way you summarized in that passage, I have never felt queer, but I have lived a queer life. It's this weird sort of confusing experience that you have where in some ways you write that you identify as a straight man, and yet that doesn't fully encapsulate the experience that you've led in 50 plus years of life. And so the other part of that was feeling maybe a sense of betrayal at not wanting to fully embrace that queer label. I mean, how do you untangle that for us?
Yeah, in the book, what I really strive for is honesty, and that the questions that seem like easy answers, for example, we will group all GLBTQ people under the same group of letters. I really wanted to ask questions rather than assume the answers. And one of them was that I've always felt like a boy and a man. That has never been at question for me. And so when I started to live as a man, and I'm married to a woman, and we were traveling cross country, and suddenly we became this heterosexual couple for the first time, again, I had to grapple with in what ways did I feel queer, and in what ways did I feel like I was living as I've always felt internally. And so that's the thing I wrestle with. And I think it is both things, but also I very much embrace that a queer life, and also note the complexity of that for me.
I think one of the big takeaways for me, and I hope other readers too, is that this was a reminder, this section was, that trans people are not a monolith, that they don't feel the same way about every issue. They don't express their gender in the same way. And in some ways, that's a decision. And in some ways, that's just whether they pass or not, right? I mean, you describe in a way, it's sort of this privilege in a way, I guess you could say, that you have of passing as a man in everyday life. Not everyone has that luxury. How do you think about that? And how do people within the trans community wrestle with that question?
Well, I think everybody wrestles with it differently. And one of the things I say in the book is, if I go into the barbershop and pass as the man I feel I am, that not being out as trans may inhibit somebody who doesn't pass but still feels no less a man. And so for me, I'm always weighing my responsibility to make space for other people to live as themselves, partly why I took the risk of writing the book and putting it out there, and then weighing these moments when I just want to sit and have my hair cut. And it's not always the same answer every time.
One of the most moving chapters, I think, is the one that is essentially a letter to your wife, Lynette. And you mentioned the sort of odd experience in recent years of traveling the country as a heterosexual couple, which is not what Lynette thought she was signing up for 20 years ago. What has that been like? I mean, the relationship that you chronicle in the book is really remarkable.
Yeah, it's one of those things that you even understand more as you have more distance from it, as I have come to know really what Lynette went through when I was transitioning. It's such a moment in time where it's hard to feel what other people are going through. And in a lot of ways, people feel bad for the partner. Oftentimes, people think you've cavalierly chosen this thing that disrupts everybody's life. And so I don't know that I could fully understand. And so what we wrestled with was the not just the impact on me and my body, but the impact on her and her identity. It was the worst and best wrestling we could have done. And I'm happy to say, you know, we are closer than we've ever been as having to really interrogate, was there love beyond gender for us?
There's this passage that I thought was so candid when you describe how your own thinking changed in some ways. For example, you had initially thought perhaps that you wouldn't have top surgery, as the saying goes. It would just be testosterone. And that when you told Lynette that, as you write, you weren't lying. You just didn't know that what you wanted would change down the line. How did that change? And how did that play into how your relationship developed?
Yeah, I think it was that I was going to have top surgery and not do testosterone, that I wouldn't live as a man, but that I would come as close as I possibly could. And I think the decision to really live as a man, for me, it felt like just another piece of the transition. And I think for Lynette, it felt like a total 180 in terms of her identity. And I think the one thing about transitioning, and again, everybody transitions differently, but a common thing is that you don't really know where you're headed until you get there. And for some people, that is headed to living on the other side of the binary. For some people, it's living as a non-binary person. It's different for everyone, but I don't know that it's not a thing you plan out and then know what the outcomes will be.
Let's talk a little bit about this binary, non-binary concept, because in addition to your own lived experience, you are a scholar of gender studies, and you sort of tackle in this book this idea of whether gender is or is not a social construct, or whether it's maybe somewhere in between. And you have, again, another compelling anecdote about this is Lynette's cousin's young son, who loves to dress as Princess Elsa, seems to really identify as feminine in so many ways. And as you describe it, there is something inherent in there. There's something intrinsic in there. No one's constructing this notion around him that he ought to behave like a girl. Could you relate to that?
Yeah, I think as a scholar and as somebody who's thought about the cultural implications and repressions of a binary, it was a really complicated experience for me to say, actually, no, for me, the experience of my masculinity very much comes from a deep interior place in my body that is not something I can sort out in my head. And that doesn't mean gender isn't a construct to some degree, but in the book I talk about how helpful is that language to a person who's trying to transition. And then I talk about my wife's cousin's son, and I don't know where he will land, but I can tell you everything about who he is and how he experiences his gender at the moment is very clear to him. And I felt that way when I was a kid of 4 years old. And so for me, I don't have the answer to where that comes from, but I think it's more complicated than saying gender's a construct.
And I can't help think about children like that when you write that if we are to survive in America's current war over who gets to have a livable life, we must confront and understand masculinity, and we must all seek some version of double consciousness. Now, for you, you've sort of had to have this double consciousness. For folks who have not been sort of forced into that type of thinking, what does that look like for others, do you think?
Well, I think one of the things that felt really important to me in the book, one, is that for trans people to have a livable life, there have to be trans stories and trans voices. And as I've been on the book tour, one of the things a lot of parents or aunts and uncles of have brothers and sisters who have children who are trans. So you see the reaching out for better understanding. The other piece of double consciousness is that we cannot live the experience of another person, and we can only experience our own embodiment, but we must think about what it is to be in the body of another. I think when I think about children in cages at the border and I put myself there, I have to live in those moments periodically because that is critical to making sure that we see everybody in their humanity, not just the people we're comfortable seeing.
What you're describing is just more empathy, it sounds like, even if you haven't had the experience of having to live in another body. imagining what that is like is important.
Yeah, I think it's empathy and I think it's real. It's more than just a feeling. I think it's a behavior and I think it's something that requires a kind of deep dive into your own understanding of yourself in relationship to others. And it takes a lot of time to inhabit spaces that are not your own or familiar.
So you're very open in this book about challenges, having conversations about your own gender identity with folks in your own family. And I wonder, how do you have these difficult conversations, not just with family members, but just with maybe particularly other men? You write about toxic masculinity a lot as you try to hold men accountable for that. How do you do it in a way that leads to productive conversations and doesn't just put them on the defensive and make them shut down and not listen to you?
Yeah, it feels to me like it takes a lot of nuance. And one of the things about writing nonfiction is it requires so much precision that it allows for ambiguity. And I think that's really what the book does. I think sometimes it's harder to do that in shorter conversations or shorter form. Depending on the context, people are really open and able to listen, and sometimes they're defensive and angry. So I fully knew that I would encounter both things.
I have to ask, could you just step back and think about the last few years? I mean, what does it feel like to be so out? I mean, there's out and then there's out, right? I mean, you're out in a very public place, in a book. You've written for the Globe magazine. You're staging this play that you're describing. What has that experience been like?
Well, my joke is that when the play comes out, maybe it's not a joke, my wife and I will be in Perth, Australia, which is the furthest point from ART. I can't really imagine watching it on stage. I mean, in one level, it's quite excruciating to be out publicly that way. At another level, when I'm out in the world and I'm touring and I'm seeing the desert of people looking for themselves and trying to find stories, I know that the risk is worth it. And it's a dangerous risk. I mean, it comes with harassment and threats and all sorts of other kinds of things that trans people experience. And so I knew I was taking that risk. And I guess I also felt, partly because I transitioned late, that I had the ground beneath me to do it.
We appreciate you doing it and sharing your story for other folks, too. P. Carl is a distinguished artist in residence at Emerson College in Boston and the Anschutz Fellow at Princeton University for the spring 2020 semester. And his new book is called Becoming a Man, The Story of a Transition. Carl, thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks, Cal. Great to be here. Thank you.